It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. The global terrorism threat becoming increasingly decentralized, with groups such as the Islamic State, also known as ISIL, spreading tentacles into regions including South Asia, Southeast Asia, Russia's North Caucasus, and Africa. U.S. State Department has released its annual report on terrorism. Here's Acting Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Justin Ciborell.
The United States and our partners around the world face a significant challenge as we seek to contend with the return of foreign terrorist fighters from Iraq and Syria, the risk of terrorist groups exploiting migratory movements, and new technology and communications platforms that enable terrorist groups to more easily recruit adherents and inspire attacks. ISIL remained the greatest terrorism threat globally. Despite the losses it sustained last year, ISIL continued to occupy large areas of Iraq and Syria. ISIL's territorial control in Iraq and Syria reached a high point in spring 2015 and began to diminish thereafter.
Ciborell says 92 countries had terror attacks in 2015, but the concentration of the attacks was geographic, he says, like it has been in recent years. A key advisor to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad rejects the need for urgent humanitarian aid for some besieged areas in Syria, while at the same time accusing the U.S. and its allies of keeping the region mired in war. Botena Shaban told reporters and those listening on the Global Alliance for Terminating ISIS and Al-Qaeda electronic feed. Officials in Somalia say security forces have killed the gunman who attacked a popular Mogadishu hotel, bringing the death toll now in that assault to 24. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack. They've carried out such attacks in the past. This is VOA News. Turkey has condemned a German parliament vote recognizing genocide, the mass killing of Armenians by Turkey's then Ottoman rulers during World War I. And the United Nations is appealing to the international community to come to the aid of millions of civilians in war-torn Yemen, struggling to survive as humanitarian conditions in the country continue to get worse. Jamie McGoldrick is the UN coordinator for Yemen.
The scale of the emergency is tremendous. The scale of the needs is massive. And the depths of the crisis is immeasurable. And the suffering that goes with that is just incredulous. Every corner you turn, everyone you meet has been affected by this crisis. Everybody who you come across in any part of this has felt this conflict, has felt this war.
The Yemeni government and Houthi rebels have been engaged in a sporadic civil war for many years, but the destruction and has increased, as well as the danger for the civilian population, seriously escalating since Saudi Arabia began its aerial campaign in March of 2015. McGoldrick says it appears as though the fighting in Yemen has gone down since UN-mediated peace negotiations started a few weeks ago. U.S. President, in the presidential primary, that is, the presidential election, U.S. Democratic Party frontrunner Hillary Clinton calling on Republican rival Donald Trump, calls him dangerous and unqualified to be president. She also was speaking on foreign policy matters in San Diego, California.
Americans aren't just electing a president in November. We're choosing our next commander-in-chief, the person we count on to decide questions of war and peace, life and death. And like many across our country and around the world, I believe the person the Republicans have nominated for president cannot do the job.
In anticipation of the address, Trump attacked Clinton on Twitter. He tweeted, and I quote, "Crooked Hillary Clinton, who I would love to call lying Hillary, is getting ready to totally misrepresent my foreign policy positions." Also in the news, autopsy results from U.S. singer Prince, who died suddenly in April, show he died of an accidental overdose of a drug called fentanyl. It is a powerful opiate painkiller with potential stronger than morphine or heroin. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Pro-democracy groups criticize coming SADC chairmanship of Swaziland's King Mswati III.
I believe that it is a shame for SADC to have a chairman of the character and caliber of King Mswati, who is an absolute monarch, who does not respect the fundamental rights of the people.
Mario Masuku is the leader of Swaziland's banned People's United Democratic Movement. Nigeria launches a billion-dollar cleanup campaign in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. Liberia's Corruption Task Force gives global witness report to the Justice Ministry for prosecution. And Kenya's government welcomes the death of Garissa University attack mastermind.
It's a little bit of relief that those who are responsible are finally getting it, although it would have been greater for us if we had an opportunity to bring them to justice.
That's Kenyan government spokesman Eric Hiraiti. South Sudan President Salva Kiir meets former rebel leader, but many issues remain unresolved. A new report says hundreds of healthcare workers are killed in 19 countries with emergencies. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Swaziland's King Mswati III is set to become the next chairman of the Southern African Development Community during the region's Heads of State Summit in Swaziland's capital, Mbabane, this August. But the kingdom's pro-democracy groups say the country's absolute monarch should not be allowed to lead the regional body. Mario Masuku, leader of the banned People's United Democratic Movement, tells reporter Peter Clotty that King Mswati's eminent chairmanship of the regional body makes a mockery of the tenets of democracy.
I believe that really it is a shame for SADC to have a chairman of the character and caliber of King Mswati, who is an absolute monarch, who does not respect the fundamental rights of the people, who does not respect the international norms of democracy. But SADC being SADC, I see it just going through for this year. He will be the chairperson and chairman of SADC.
The king recently told a parliamentary forum of SADC that the introduction of monarchical democracy, where parliamentarians are voted for directly by the people, has been accepted by Swazis and that it is working effectively in Swaziland. Why do you doubt this?
Why take a divergent form from the normal democratic principles that are known? And in Swaziland, there is no freedom of association. Political parties are not allowed. Freedom of assembly, we are not allowed to hold meetings. Freedom of expression, there are laws that curtail what you can say and what you cannot say.
Some people are saying that King Mswati taking over the chairmanship of SADC should be a pride for all Swazis. Why are some people opposed to that?
Swaziland has been divided into two sections of society. One society is the one that benefits from the corrupt and unscrupulous manner of governance. And those will always back whatever the monarchy says because they benefit. The rest are the poor, are the unemployed, are all the people that respect the fundamental human rights and seek for a democratic dispensation. Those are the people that will say no.
You were recently released. Under what condition did they release you?
The question has been asked many times. But firstly, it is that I'm out on bail. Firstly, I am not allowed to address political meetings. I am not allowed, and that is any meeting that is above 10 people, I'm not allowed to address. The second one is that all my travel documents are held by the security forces. I may not leave Swaziland unless I go to a high court for any valid reasons. I report on the last Friday of every month to the security forces, and that is killing me in that I may not exercise my fundamental rights of freedom of expression, freedom of movement, and so forth. To me, it is like I'm now in a broader prison than I was in the high maximum security prison I was in for the past year.
Mario Masuku is the leader of Swaziland's banned People's United Democratic Movement, a pro-democracy group. He spoke with reporter Peter Clote from the capital, Mbabane. Kenya's government has welcomed the reported death of the Al-Shabaab militant who allegedly organized the massacre at Garissa University College last year. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Kenyan spokesman Eric Karafe says the government welcomes the news that special forces in southern Somalia had killed the suspected organizer of the April 2015 attack on Kenya's Garissa University. In an interview with VOA in Nairobi, Karafe said his death will help heal the wounds left by the deadly assault.
What we would want to say as a government is that every victory against terrorism is very welcome. The pain and suffering of the parents, friends and relatives of those who died in Garissa is still very fresh amongst us, and therefore it's a little bit of relief that those who are responsible are finally getting it, although it would have been greater for us if we had an opportunity to bring them to justice.
Mohamed Mahamoud, better known as Dulia Dane, was believed to be the organizer of the gruesome attack, in which Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 148 people, nearly all of them students. Miriam Njiri was a student at Garissa University at the time, but has since transferred to Moi University in Eldoret, after that school admitted all Garissa students unconditionally following the attack.
Now that the mastermind is dead, I'm so happy, I'm so relieved. I'm relieved that we will not plan another attack on another university, but I'm also afraid that another mastermind will come up.
Dulia Dane was killed Tuesday night in the town of Bulo Gadud, a town loyal to Al-Shabaab, about 30 kilometers north of the port of Kismayo. A local Somali official told VOA that Dulia Dane was killed in a raid by U.S.-trained Somali commandos. Another official said the militant was killed by U.S. missiles. However, a U.S. military spokesman said Thursday that American forces played only an advise and assist role in a ground operation carried out by the Somali National Army. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Liberia, the special task force appointed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to look into the Global Witness Corruption Report has turned over its files to the Ministry of Justice to lead the prosecution. House of Representatives Speaker Alice Tyler and Senator Vonnie Sherman, who is chairman of President Sirleaf's ruling Unity Party, have been indicted for bribery, criminal conspiracy, and economic sabotage. A report by the UK-based Global Witness alleges that over $950,000 in bribes and other suspicious payments were made to top Liberian officials by the Britain-based Sable Mining Company and its Liberian lawyer, Vonnie Sherman. According to the report, Sable Mining wanted to get the concession rights to Liberia's Wologizi iron ore deposit. Task Force Chairman Councillor Jay Fonati Kofa says turning over the case files does not mean the task force job is over.
What the task force was able to do was just to speed up the process. Now that we are in the prosecution phase of the matter, the task force, my job from state, which is one of the agencies on the task force, is to provide support at this point. It's only normal and natural that the agency responsible for prosecution take the lead at this point.
Councillor Kofa, the Justice Ministry could have gone ahead and done what you did.
Remember that at the time of the appointment of the task force, there was no Justice Minister proper serving. The Minister of Justice only took office on Monday. Now that you have a Minister of Justice proper, it's only right, lawful, and proper that he takes the lead on the prosecution of this matter.
So what happens to the other people who had been mentioned in the Global Witness report? Have they been indicted, or are you going to go to indict them?
I anticipate next week that a grand jury will reconvene, and I anticipate, based on the evidence we have reviewed, that there will be additional indictments handed down. The fact that there were not indictments this week was a prosecutorial strategy to attempt to do a final list of indictees Plus, added with the fact that a lot of the people who are on the list to be indicted were people who were cooperating, have brought some evidence that if weighed, may be exculpatory, and so the investigators and the prosecutors got to weigh the evidence provided against the evidence of the global witness report to make a determination. That's a little bit slow and deliberative process. They will be working through this weekend to get that done.
Earlier in the week, I spoke with an official of the Congress for Democratic Change political party, who said they appreciate your task force and what the president has done to go after alleged corruption, but they would like for this process to be expanded to include other past allegations of corruption.
The primary role at stake right now on the task force is to call up all of the GAC reports not currently being investigated by the LACC or being prosecuted by the Ministry of Justice. Our initial step will be to do what we call compliance screening. That is, we're going to take a number of persons of interest that have been listed in the GAC reports. We will call them in. We will discuss with them as to what are the implications in the report relating to them. We will attempt to clear up that matter administratively. If we cannot, we will refer them to the LACC for further investigation. So indeed, our approach is explained, given the press release that the president issued at the first time. It was not only global witness, it was also all matters that may be related to the issue of corruption in our country, especially General Auditing Commission reports, which were not currently under investigation or prosecution.
Councillor Jay Funati-Kofa is chairman of the Special Corruption Task Force. He was speaking with me from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 3rd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Life in Lofa County, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County in Central Liberia. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Nigeria on Thursday launched a $1 billion cleanup campaign to restore the environment in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. For more than 60 years, the area has suffered environmental pollution due to the exploration and production activities of oil companies, including the Anglo-Dutch giant Shell Oil Company. Viewers William Eagle spoke with reporter Paul Okolo in Abuja and asked him how badly Ogoniland has been degraded by pollution.
The area has experienced pollution from way back as the early 50s when oil exploration and production started in Nigeria. And it has continued unabated until now, even as we speak. Although Shell was forced to leave Ogoniland in the early 1990s, I believe around 1993, oil spills have not stopped in the area because of the pipelines that pass through the area that have been damaged, that are still seeping oil. There is also the incidence of oil theft, which is causing oil spillage, and the activities of people who are refining locally. These are all contributing to the problem that has been there for over 50 years.
What will the cleanup entail?
To start with, the government is authorizing the establishment of an authority, of the Land Environmental Authority, that will do the work of coordinating, administering, and managing the whole exercise. There will also be an environmental fund that is supposed to be funded by oil industry operators and the government. The initial amount for the first 5 years is $1 billion. This is supposed to be used to get the work started in earnest. And besides that, there is expected to be a coordination effort to bring together the government, the oil operators, the civil society organizations, and even the local community. All of these institutions are supposed to be put on ground right away so that the work can begin.
President Muhammadu Buhari was earlier expected to launch the program. Why was Vice President Osinbajo given the assignment instead?
From speculations in the media, security agencies are concerned about the safety of the president following threats by the new militant group in the Niger Delta, the so-called Niger Delta Avengers. The other one is because of the meeting of leaders of the region in Dakar, the security meeting, which is supposed to start tomorrow. Some people are speculating that the president was planning to attend this meeting, and so he had to cancel the Ogoni appearance.
That was reporter Paul Okolo in Abuja, Nigeria, speaking with VOA's William Igo. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, first vice president and former rebel leader Riek Machar, along with Vice President James Wani Iga, met this week to talk about the remaining stumbling blocks impeding full implementation of the peace agreement. John Tanzat of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports.
The undersecretary of the National Committee for Information and Public Relations says the three leaders discussed the demilitarization of Juba Town, cantonment sites for SPLM-IO forces in the three regions of Upper Nile, Equatorian Bahr al-Ghazal, as well as the continuing disputes over 28 states. William Ezekiel says the leaders agreed to form a national committee to study the proposed states and their borders.
After agreeing on the number of the states, then a technical committee will be established to identify and demarcate borders between the states. So the first major work is to discuss the issue of the number of the states. Of course, in their work, they will work in consultation with the community-based groups. They will work also with chiefs. They will work also with any relevant body they see of major interest to this.
Ezekiel says the committee is expected to report back to the leaders within 30 days with a recommendation on the number of states and their borders. The committee is composed of 15 members from the SPLM ruling party, the SPLM in opposition, the former detainees, the political parties, and three from the Troika countries of the United States, Britain, and Norway. Tanzania and South Africa will also contribute members. Ezekiel says the meeting addressed the most important issues blocking the road to peace.
It's a positive step forward in the implementation of the peace agreement. As you know, this issue of the date has been considered, has been widely regarded, not only inside South Sudan, even at the international level, as a major violation to the peace agreement.
The three leaders are expected to meet again this week to talk about the issues pertaining to full implementation of the peace agreement.
That was John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reporting. A report from the World Health Organization says nearly 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed and more than 1,500 wounded in 19 countries with emergencies, and that many of the incidents were intentional. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
This first effort to consolidate and analyze data on attacks on healthcare in emergency settings around the world sheds light on the severity and frequency of the problem. The findings show widespread violations of international humanitarian law, which, if proven, could amount to war crimes. Rick Brennan is the director of the WHO's Department of Emergency and Risk Management. He says the figures presented in the report are startling and indicate the devastating impact that attacks against health workers have on communities.
Every attack on healthcare disrupts the delivery of health services and denies communities access to essential health services in emergencies the time that they really need them most. Perhaps one of the most concerning findings of the report is that close to two-thirds of the attacks on healthcare, on health facilities, on health workers, on ambulances, on patients have been deliberate.
The report says Syria had the most reported attacks on healthcare each year, twice as many as any other country or territory in 2014, and nearly four times as many in 2015. Syria is followed by the West Bank and Gaza Strip, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Ukraine, and Central African Republic in the rankings of the 19 countries surveyed. The report says the Central African Republic is the only country where attacks against healthcare have gone down. The report attributes the drop to successful interventions by the International Committee of the Red Cross with armed groups in that country. The report's author, Erin Kenny, says attacks that hinder the delivery of preventive or curative health services occur in many emergency settings, not just in situations of conflict.
That's everything from the Ebola healthcare workers who were killed in Guinea, the polio workers who are attacked during vaccination. So while the bombings we see are the things that get the most visibility and the most press probably, the attacks we have in this report includes looting, arson, kidnapping, torture, execution.
While this report documents attacks against healthcare in 2014 and 2015, the World Health Organization says the horror persists. Over the past couple of months, it notes a number of hospitals and health facilities in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and elsewhere have been hit with a heavy loss of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Marco Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Ethiopian Almaz Ayana clocked 14 minutes and 12.59 seconds in women's 5,000 meters to set an IAAF Diamond League record in the Italian capital Rome on Thursday. It's also the world's quickest time for the event this year. Kenyans Mercy Cherono and Viola Kibiwot were placed second and third, respectively. Consensus Kipruto prevailed in men's 3,000 meters steeplechase in the world's quickest time this year of 8 minutes and 1.41 seconds to lead Jairus Birech and Paul Kipsiele Koech in a 1-3 Kenyan medal podium sweep. South African world champion Wade van Niekerk won 400 meters in 44.19 seconds, with Botswana's Isaac Makwala placed third, while South Africa's Wenda Nel was second in women's 400 meter hurdles in 54.61 seconds. South African Caster Semenya won women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 56.64 seconds, with Burundi's Francine Nyonsaba placed second. Kenyan Elijah Manangoi clocked 3 minutes and 33.96 seconds to lead Robert Biwott in a 1-2 Kenyan 1500-meter triumph. On the infield, Sunet Fulyun prevailed in the women's javelin with a 61.95-meter effort, as Victor Hogan placed second in men's discus with a throw of 64.05 meters. Turning to football, Algeria outwitted their hosts Seychelles 2-0 in their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in Victoria on Thursday. Consequently, Algeria qualified from Group J for the Nations Cup, having amassed 13 points with one game in hand to complete the qualifying contest. Today, Friday, Djibouti hosts Tunisia, Mauritania engage Cameroon, and Libya play Morocco in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. Tomorrow, Saturday, African champions Ivory Coast are at home to Gabon in Bouaké. Burundi engage Senegal, Namibia face Niger, Rwanda play Mozambique, Sao Tome and Principe plays Cape Verde Islands, as Guinea-Bissau face Zambia. Elsewhere, Tanzania engage Egypt, Sierra Leone welcome Sudan, Botswana meet Uganda, South Sudan face Mali, and Gambia engage South Africa. On Sunday, Liberia plays Togo, Kenya face Republic of Congo, Madagascar host the Democratic Republic of Congo, Swaziland meet Guinea, as Comoro Islands play Burkina Faso. Elsewhere, Central African Republic engage Angola, Mauritius hosts Ghana, Lesotho face Ethiopia, Zimbabwe host Malawi, and Benin meet Equatorial Guinea. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somali officials say security forces have killed the gunman who attacked a popular Mogadishu hotel, bringing the death toll from the assault to 24. And that's it for this Friday, June 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butter in Washington saying have a lovely weekend, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.